Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hi, this is Mary Robson for Nature Now, the week of mid-January 2017. We are thawing from nearly 2 weeks of sub-freezing temperatures, but the forecast now considers flood watches from returning rains. And the dawn temperature on January 17th at my house was 48 degrees, quite different from where we've been. Trumpeter swans are showing up now. I saw some photos last week from the Skagit Valley and in familiar spots like Beaver Valley in Jefferson County. Today we'll repeat an interview on these iconic birds with Bob Bokelhide. But first, the mystery sound. If you grew up in the East, you know this sound. Observations, thanks to Charlie Fleshman for adding his voice to these.
Stars, the open winter night skies during freezing nights gave a spectacular appreciation of starlight, rarely seen. Also of our fellow planets, Venus shone brilliantly above the horizon just at dusk, brightest object in the sky after the moon. Look in the southwest sky at dawn for the moon, now waning but sharply visible.
And unexpected bird sightings. This is at a hummingbird feeder, two chickadees and one orange-crowned warbler during the coldest of days. My feeder does not have bee guards, so the liquid is freely available. Orange-crowned warblers often visit the hummingbird feeders year-round, but I have never seen a chickadee. Perhaps they need water in the frozen world. Or liquid food may be simpler for accessible energy than prying seeds out of Douglas fir cones. Sturdy green native plants. Now we're thawing. Green remains our most visible color. This is completely unlike winter in colder zones. Even with very cold temperatures locally, native broadleaf evergreens look fresh and untouched. Hardy here, Mahonia, Salal, Geranium, Macrorhizum, Sword Fern, they've all resisted leaf alteration during the low 20s experienced last week. Imagine the bleak midwinter if we lacked these green understory plants.
100 bald eagles. A watcher visiting the Skagit Valley reported counting over 100 bald eagles last week, including 15 in one tree. Given the size of the birds, that must have been a sturdy tree. Monica Weiland's photo included a striking huge eagle nest in the tree's midsection. Decades ago, seeing one eagle was cause for celebration. Bald eagles will always be astonishing, especially as their numbers continue to increase.
And finally, a poem for thaw. All of you have walked past little pockets of ice and snow, and this week we'll see the rain melting all those away, especially the ones left in shady spots. Here is a poem from Robert Frost observing the end of snow and thinking that that snow might be an old newspaper. A patch of old snow. There's a patch of old snow in a corner that I should have guessed was a blowaway paper the rain had brought to rest. It is speckled with grime as if small print overspread it. The news of a day I've forgotten, if I ever read it. Hi, Bob. Today I'd like to talk about trumpeter swans because many of us see them but don't know much about their lives. So can you start by telling us a little bit about what types of swans we have, where they originate, and about when do they get here?
Sure. Well, thank you, Mary. So there's two native swan species that we see here in Washington State. The big guys, the large ones, are trumpeter swans, and trumpeter swans that we have here mostly nest in Alaska. They nest in the forested areas of Alaska. After the nesting season, they fly south, usually in the fall, September, October. They arrive here in November. The first ones arrive here in November or so. And we have trumpeter swans gathering not only the North Olympic Peninsula, which is a relatively small group compared to the large groups that are over in the Skagit Valley, like near Mount Vernon, and the Samish Flats and all the way up into Whatcom County and in southern British Columbia. So those are trumpeter swans. The smaller swan species that we have is the tundra swan, used to be called the whistling swan, and they mostly nest up in the Arctic. They don't nest where there are forests. They nest in the kind of the lowlands around the Arctic, both in Alaska and Canada. They fly further south than trumpeter swans usually, so big numbers of them are down in starting about the southern part of Washington into the Willamette Valley of Oregon and down into California. So we're in the big trumpeter swan area here. And they're coming here to spend the winter. They usually arrive in November sometime. Numbers increase through the winter until finally, sometime in February, March, they reach a peak, and then they decline very quickly, and they're gone. Usually the last few are here in the first few days of April.
One of the things that has happened for Clallam County is that you've been keeping track of swans through this citizen science project, the swan monitoring. These volunteers help keep track of the swans, particularly in the Squim Dungeness Valley. I talked with one person who was one of the people who started it, Mary Porter Solberg, and she wrote about why she loves swans, and I think we'll just give Mary her words here. She said, "As long as I can remember, swans have always captivated me in a way other birds could not compete. From the downy cygnet stage of their lives until they emerge as magnificent adult birds, they have fascinated me." And she said that she spent time drawing them and reading books about them when she was a child. So that gets us started on the swan monitoring project. How does that work?
Swans have a real draw for us, you know, not only in literature and in music. And, you know, there's many ways that people are attracted to swans. The Ugly Duckling is another good example. The project here started back about, the year 2010 or so. Actually, going back even further, we do a Christmas bird count here in the Squim Dungeness Valley. We had no trumpeter swans at all on our count here until 1982. And the numbers picked up slowly over the years. We had a big jump up in 2008. Between 2008 and 2011, we started to see occasionally there were a sick swan, you know, a swan that would separate from the group, that would hang out, looked like it was having some sort of malaise, and eventually they may die. The question was, what was going on? Well, there were a number of people here. One was Shelley Amott, who works for the State Wildlife Department, State Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Martha Jordan, who was very active in the Trumpeter Swan Society, now part of the Washington Swan Stewards, and they were wondering whether lead could have been the problem. Apparently, swans are very susceptible to lead poisoning, and the question is, where could they be picking up lead? They could ingest just a few old spent shotgun pellets that could have been lying around on the ground for years. Lead shot has been illegal for waterfowl hunting for decades, back to the 1990s. And many places even before that. So they were ingesting this from somewhere out there. We didn't know where. And so the question was, let's follow the swans and see where they're spending their time. If we see sick swans after that, then maybe we can get a connection and figure out where they're ingesting the lead pellets. So both Martha Jordan and Shelley Amon approached the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, of which Mary Porter Solberg is the conservation chair, and ask, would we be interested in doing surveys, just driving around? A wonderful example of a citizen science project where volunteers basically just have to recognize a swan. The swans are so obvious standing out in these fields, people would have to count them, be able to separate adult swans from juvenile swans by coloration, and have a regular route of where people go and they communicate with each other. So the idea was, starting in 2011, let's do these surveys, driving around, checking out where the swans are. We now are up to 24 people who have helped with this project as far as driving around and checking out the swans. So it's turned into a really neat project. Where I fit in, I have not been one of the 24 people who have driven around, but we've now accumulated quite a bit of data. And so you can imagine, when it first started in 2011 and 12 and 2012-13, there were many surveys done. People were tripping over each other, going out trying to count swans. And so we have a lot of data from those years. We then cut back in 2013-14 and 14-15. So we do it as a more regular survey, and this year as well, from 2015-16. So regardless, we have all this data. We want to know what does it mean. And so some of the basic questions, like how many swans are showing up every year, and where do they go while they're here? Why are they, you know, what habitats are they using? And how do their ages change over time? So all these basic questions beyond what we might be interested in, what might be killing swans because of lead. It turns out now there have been fewer birds affected by lead since then. Other problems have arisen. I'll talk about them in a second here.
Okay. The other thing is, because this actually is a citizen science project, I looked at the data sheet, and the people who are doing this need to be very particular about everybody reporting the same thing. So you're not confronted with some, one person's impression and another person's impression, but it's very regularized.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's particularly true when doing, you know, any sort of science project. You need to have a fairly strict protocol that requires people to be consistent in their observations. And not only because it gives us a better picture of the birds, but also it makes it a lot easier in the end when you're trying to compile the numbers and make sense out of it. One person might call a field, say, a pasture. Another person might call it a cover crop. Another person might call it winter wheat. We need to somehow standardize those so that people are all consistent in what they're they're describing the data as they do it.
Well, the other part of the description is that in a swan flock, you're going to see adults and juveniles. And the juveniles are a kind of grayish-brown and a little smaller. But I wondered if you could talk a bit about these family groups. Do they stay together the times that they're here? Do they move around? How does a person know that they haven't already just counted the same swans on one day?
There's always a chance that the swans are flying around while the people are moving around and driving around, but they have regular places that they go to where they would look for the swans. As far as the young swans go, they stand out quite well. Trumpeter swans, the juveniles are this darker grayish color through the whole winter, and so they really don't start their molt out of that plumage until the following spring. So when the volunteers are going to a field, they can count the number of adults and the number of immatures that they see out in these fields. And to me, this is one of the most interesting things that have come out of this project is when we look at the number of juveniles that show up, they usually reach a peak sometime in fairly early, like November, December, and their numbers change a little bit through the winter, but they don't have the same increase as the adults. Oftentimes, the adult numbers keep going up. And it appears that the family groups, the successful adults who have young birds with them, remain in the areas somewhere around here fairly consistently. That's the way that I interpret the data. Maybe I'm totally wrong about this, but I interpret the data that these family groups that were successful breeding adults stay with their young through the season in these spots. We get this big increase in adults later on in the late winter and particularly through February and March, and those seem to be maybe either failed breeding adults, birds that never had chicks, maybe they left the breeding grounds after their chicks died, or they could be young birds. Trumpeter swans usually don't nest for the first time until they're maybe 4 to 7 years old. And so these young birds may pair in their first couple of years, but they may go for 2 or 3 years before they actually settle down and have a successful nest. So those birds are traveling together. And what interesting thing about swans is they're perhaps the most monogamous bird species that's out there. There's probably a few exceptions, like wren tits and things like that, but these swans are traveling as pairs, breeding pairs, through the whole year. We hear about birds mating for life. Well, trumpeter swans may be a good example of that. There are probably a few examples where maybe there are splits. Maybe and certainly there are records of where one of the mates dies and the other mate will pair with another individual at some other point. But in general, they're traveling as mated pairs, whether they have chicks or not. But it seems like the adults with young arrive in early winter or late fall. They stay fairly continuously here, but then the unattended adults are traveling around. They may be going maybe from the Skagit Valley over here on a regular basis. Maybe they're flying from here back to the Skagit Valley. The numbers are going up and down through the winter. There's no real strong consistency all the way through. Sometimes it seems like they're increasing. Sometimes it seems like they decrease. But overall, the general trend is the numbers pick up through the winter, They reach a peak in February, March, and then very quickly they depart in the spring.
But one of the things that contributes to the success of nesting was, we talked a little bit about this, the little cygnets, when they hatch, are precocial. They can hop out of the nest in 24 hours and swim and eat right away?
Yes, and this is when they're most vulnerable to, say, weather problems. If they get some really cold weather snap in Alaska, that might cause widespread death of these very young cygnets before they're able to thermoregulate. They have to learn how to feed. The parents don't feed them. The parents take them to the food, but those young cygnets have to learn the ropes, so to speak, and figure out which foods they should use. Apparently there's examples of the parents actually kind of stirring up sediment in some of these lakes to try to get the young cygnets to see what foods are available to them.
Wow.
So there's a learning process, and they don't all make it.
Mm-hmm.
Some years they have widespread breeding failure. Some years they do very well. This is typical in wild bird populations.
Well, what I was wondering also was that obviously there is something in the local habitat here that attracts and supports these swans. I mean, they're not headed for the Cascades to sit on a mountain. They're here. So what is it that they need from this area?
Yeah, well, there's some great habitat here. The first thing they need is wide open spaces. We have these agricultural fields here, some of the areas around Sequim, like out by Schmuck Road and Port Williams Road, areas by Olympic Game Farm, some of these large areas where there's big fields. Swans during the daytime want to have feeding spots where they have a nice view around them. They want to see where there might be a predator approaching. They also want to have good food sources. And here, some of the best food that they've found in some of these fields, like corn, a spent corn field where it's been harvested. There's still lots of corn cobs lying around in the ground. This is nirvana for these swans coming here in the fall and the winter. An example right now, there's a field over by the Sequim Airport that they've been using this year that they did not use before, and this is the first year that apparently it was planted in corn, so they're using that. Other places here, Nash Huber with Nash's Organic Farm has planted carrots for many years, and it turns out at a certain time during the winter, that is also a very favorite spot. Particularly after they've harvested the carrots, the swans will go in and consume all the carrots they can get to. Other areas, they're general vegetarians, so they'll be nibbling on grasses. Some of the cover crops that they grow around here are favorite foods. So there's a wide variety of things that they'll eat here. And there's not only the habitat that they need during the day when they're feeding, but they also need habitat at night for roosting. So they may have special ponds in the area that they go to during the nighttime, or in late evening they'll fly to these ponds.
So they actually spend the night floating on some form of water.
Yes, and sometimes they float on salt water. We'll see them in flocks out in Dungeness Bay around the corner at Jamestown, where they'll hang out. And for those of you over on the Quimper Peninsula, places like Anderson Lake is a place where they'll go at nighttime.
And it's a good place to go to see them wake up in the morning.
Just fly from there out to the fields down at Center and Beaver Valley and places like that.
What do you think is the biggest threat to them now? Obviously, spent lead shot has killed birds, but what at this time is hurting them or making life tough for them? What about their future in this area?
Yeah, well, these are great questions. One of the big problems in our area here around Sequim Dungeness Valley has been collisions with power lines. Shelley Ament has worked with the Clallam PUD to put markers or reflectors up on the power lines, which apparently highlight them a little bit more so the swans are less likely to run into them. In some cases, swans with their long wingspan may touch a couple power lines and be electrocuted. But mostly it's a collision. They're taking off in dusk and they don't see the power lines and they collide with them and it causes...
Their wingspread is about 9 feet, isn't it? Or a little more?
Extreme. So eight to 9 feet, somewhere in that range.
But if they're flying, that's a heck of a lot of wingspread. We have time for just one more question. We could go on and on, but the last question you've dealt with a little bit. If we didn't have open agriculture going on, we would not have these swans here.
I think that's very true. You know, there's some of them that may learn to be in areas that don't have large agricultural fields, but in general, that's true. If we're going to have large numbers of swans, trumpeter swans, particularly in our area, the lesson is these open agricultural spaces are a wonderful spot for them.
And they're not only good for us who like to eat, they're very good for the swans who like to eat then.
That's true. And okay. So we need to support farms that are providing this open space, whether they're crops or dairies or whatever, they provide important space for swans.
That's wonderful. You have looked at the question or touched on where people can go to see swans in the area. If they wanted to just drop in at Dungeness Audubon Society, they could get more information about where to look?
Sure. But for those people who live over in Port Townsend, the great spot to go to is down in the Center Valley.
Yes.
South of Chimicum, along the Beaver Valley. There are a number of farms there that have open space. Fortunately, the swans are here in the wintertime when most of these farms aren't growing crops. And so basically they need areas where they're not disturbed and they can survive in a nice, happy situation.
They can survive and give us a lot of pleasure by knowing that they're there. Bob, thank you so much. I appreciate your being here and letting us think a little bit more about the birds that make our winter so special. So thank you.
Thank you.
Finally, our mystery sound. I have hoped that this animal had not made it to the Olympic Peninsula, but alas, it is the eastern gray squirrel. They may have hitchhiked over in someone's lunchbox, or they can swim. They've been seen here for over a decade. Apparently, they were introduced to Washington as early as 1925. Wendy Tweeten reported seeing about a dozen chasing each other up and down a tree in Chetsamoka Park last week. This is not good news. Gray squirrels chasing each other lead to more gray squirrels since they mate in midwinter. Strong, large, and prolific, mature females can produce 2 litters a year. They threaten native squirrels. Eastern gray squirrels are considered an invasive species here. They join pigeons, possums, and raccoons as pests. It is legal to hunt them as long as the hunter is certain of their identification. Having lived in North Carolina for 8 years, I have eaten Southern Brunswick stew, which, thanks to hunters, contains far more than just tomatoes and chicken. I am now older and mostly vegetarian. Events. The Native Plant Society, Olympic Branch, announces that their meetings will now be held on the third Tuesday rather than the second Tuesday of the month. Update your calendars.
January 18th, 7 p.m., Audubon Society, Dungeness River Audubon Center. The natural world always has a story to share, celebrating what is right with the world with Alan Bauer.
Every Wednesday morning, there is a bird walk from 8:30 to 10 a.m. at the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. And finally, Saturday, January 21st, the Yard and Garden Series from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, presented by the Jefferson County Master Gardener Foundation. Clematis all year with Linda Butler at the Community Center, Port Townsend. And that's it for Nature Now. Thanks to Charlie Fleshman for engineering our words and sounds, and we hope you have enjoyed this program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ, on Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are available on the website www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing song is Swan, sung by Wright Said Fred. Snap of breaking heart.